Sarah Pepper, a Director of Creative Cardiff, has kindly agreed to chair this last session of the day. We're going to be looking at the how. Over to you, Sarah, to introduce your panellists. Thank you.
Thank you, Auriel. Prinhandar, good afternoon, everybody, and a very warm welcome to the final session of what has been a really interesting day with lots of lively debate. So we're looking forward to wholly delivering that in the final panel session, and I'm very grateful to have the opportunity to be here and to be joined by such a brilliant panel. So far we have heard the what and the why, and this session focuses on the how. So the title, the main question that we have here is, how can small nations, regions and cities use their soft power capital to strengthen global engagement? And in particular, we're going to ask the panelists to explore the relationship between government and the variety of different stakeholders who could be playing a part in this to apply a strategic approach for soft power. But before I introduce our brilliant panellists, I wanted to take on the mantle that was just given to us about storytelling and give you a tiny example of how this has come into my world very keenly in an article that was published this week, but that goes back a couple of months ago. At the beginning of the year, I was invited by the Thai government and the British Council in Thailand to deliver some training to a group of people who were setting up creative hubs in 9 universities across the country. The work I do focuses on the creative economy in Wales, and we've been doing a lot of work around creative hubs and co-working spaces and how this is important to the development of the creative industries and cultural sector more broadly. So I could understand very keenly why I was asked to go and share our learning and exchange knowledge in this area. And actually, a lot of our work in this area is very values-based, and I think that resonated very much with what we've discussed today. But here comes my Bolshie moment in the last few weeks. I've never thought of it like that, but now I can describe it in that way. The training that I was asked to deliver was actually formally opened by the Minister of Commerce, because this is quite a large part of their thinking about the creative economy in the country. I gave the Minister a love spoon, and that was the start of our storytelling and sharing very much about that extension of friendship and thinking about our culture more broadly. I then had my second Bolshie moment. As he'd accepted the love spoon and my story, I suggested that maybe they might want to come on a visit to the UK, but make sure they didn't just stay in London, that they would come to Cardiff to see what we were doing in co-working creative hubs in the city. 2 weeks ago, a ministerial delegation from Thailand came to the UK, and they did come to Cardiff for 48 hours, and they did come and visit our very special co-working and creative spaces in the city. Off the back of that, on Monday this week, an article was published in the Bangkok Post about how Cardiff has influenced the cultural strategy they're developing in Chiang Mai. So I'm pleased that I was able to take on my Bolshie moment, and I think it's up to all of us to either have a stack of love spoons or be prepared to step up when the opportunity arises. Right, enough from me. Thank you for letting me share that story. So I'd like to introduce our brilliant panel for this session. We have Geraint Talvin-Davis, former chair of Welsh National Opera. We have Shona McCarthy, Director of Edinburgh Festival Fringe Society. We have Shane Shapiro, Chief Executive Officer of Sound Diplomacy. And finally, I'd like to welcome Nick van der Malier, General Representative of the Flanders Government in the United Kingdom. So as with the other panel sessions, I'd like to open this up to the 4 panelists to give 4 or 5 minutes in response to our main headline here, how can small nations, regions, and cities use their soft power capital to strengthen global engagement. Geraint, would you be so kind to kick us off, please?
Right. A quick story from me then, because I am of a certain age that allows me to remember an American comedian called Mort Sahl, who was around at the time that John Kennedy was inaugurated. And Mort Sahl had this great riff. He said that, did you hear Kennedy's speech? He said, ask not what America can do for you, but what you can do for America. And he said, great speech, but kind of vague. And he said, I went down to the mall. There was a big motorcade with the president going past. And he said, and as he went past, I yelled at the president, hey, sir, I said, what do you want me to do? And he said, the President Kennedy turned and looked at me and said, even more. I think it's time to get down actually to some specifics. Wales has had a bit of a reputation, as many small societies do, being the land of the pulled punch. I think it's time to be a little bit more critical than we may have been. There are some, I'll say straight away, Wales has fantastic assets. You've heard about them. You've heard about some wonderful things from the First Minister this morning a few of the things that are actually happening. But I just want to tell a little history. I was very, very struck by Jonathan McClory's report on soft power. Right? But I tell you, there was something frighteningly familiar about it. I remember when I was at the Institute of Welsh Affairs in 1998, taking a proposal to the Welsh Development Agency, as it then was, to set up a global Wales platform and database. We were given £50,000 to do it. We set up the system, we engaged people to do it, and we were going to produce a kind of a database of international contacts all around the world. The Assembly was created in 1999, and they suddenly came to us and said, we're going to take it in-house, and they did nothing. Myself and some colleagues, we got involved in 2002 in drafting a culture strategy for what was then the Labour-Lib Dem coalition. That placed a great emphasis. I mean, I'll give you, and this was a document published in 2002, two objectives: to improve the international profile of Wales through the use of its cultural assets and to increase the number of international activities using Wales as its venue. Second, to encourage cultural professionals in Wales to play a full part in international cultural networks. Yeah. The coalition lasted a couple of years, nothing much happened. 2004, abolition of the WDA. The WDA had been the prime driver of Wales's international presence. And I can remember, I saw it at first hand, because in the 90s I was at the BBC, and I remember we took the BBC National Orchestra of Wales on a three-week tour of Japan. We finished up after the final concert in Tokyo. There was a great gathering at the British Embassy. I happened the following day to travel back on the same plane as the British ambassador, and he said, that was the biggest turnout of main board directors from the main Japanese companies I've ever seen in one room. And that was, you know, partly because the push and the drive of the WDA and a chairman in David Robedo, who was familiar with international business. You know? So I think there are a number of things that we've got to be careful of here. One of the proposals in Jonathan McClory's report, which I think is an excellent report, particularly because it echoes a report I wrote last year. and one of the questions he asked was about the machinery. How do you overhaul the machinery? And I think that one of the proposals, in fact, I put forward then, and I'm glad to say he's put it forward himself. He's asking, really, should the Welsh government take a lead? Absolutely, it should take a lead. And I think that you cannot continue with the current system where the external affairs brief remains on the fringes of the First Minister's time. The real contrast to me is with the setup in Scotland, where there is a cabinet secretary for culture, tourism and external affairs, supported by a minister for international development and Europe. You know? They've got a remit that covers the creative industries, fair trade, international development, Scottish diaspora, cross-government coordination on Europe, international relations and major events. Now, you know, that you can argue, you know, whether that is the perfect model, but you've given a minister absolute responsibility for this brief. And I think, you know, we are lucky in the sense that, you know, one First Minister's period is coming to an end. There'll be a new First Minister in post. This is the perfect opportunity, I think, to put something really strong into his into his entry. Indeed. My mistake. We've got to have a much more fully fledged international strategy than we've got, that embraces government, embraces cultural organisations, universities, civil society. But there has to be that lead minister there. The other thing that it strikes me too, you know, we do have to bring these economic and cultural objectives together. And one of the things that I talked about, because the report I did last year was around the impact of Brexit on higher education and on culture in Wales. You know. And you have to have an internationally focused infrastructure that can assert the Welsh presence internationally. But also, let's not forget this, we have to assert ourselves within the UK's own networks too. Because you know, that is going to be a particular issue, I think, post-Brexit. Third point for me is, in Jonathan McClory's report, Wales is doing very, very well on sport, much less well on culture. And I think that one of the things that we've got to be very careful of here is that we don't set up a false contest between sport and the arts. It's got to be a both-and strategy and not an either-or strategy. But I think we have to do something to actually place a higher profile on the cultural side of things, and certainly, as Jonathan suggests again, to build international scale events here at home. Now, I know that the national companies in Wales are already talking together, you know, how they can actually combine to produce something very big. In my view, it would not take an inordinate amount of additional money, because I think to some extent it's a question of moving the pieces of the jigsaw amongst all the national arts organisations, you know, so they fit together into some kind of, you know, a festival period. And there are different options for that. Major events, that's a big festival here, I think, is well overdue. Third thing I would do, in fact, is to expand and buttress the role of Wales Arts International. This is a joint venture between the Arts Council and the British Council. To my mind, I argued in the past that I've always felt it's in the wrong place. Not that Wales Arts International is in the wrong place, but that you actually have a European, you've had a European Creative Europe desk that has actually sat within the European Funding Office and not actually within the Arts Council and Wales Arts International, unlike the structures that they put in place in Scotland and in Northern Ireland. Roger Lewis mentioned earlier an audit of international activity. I think that it's one aspect, I think, of the monitoring of the national organisations by the Arts Council. I think the Arts Council has to write the international remit strongly into the remits of the national organisations and not suppose that it's a nice to have. It's got, you know, it's an essential part, I think, of the role of our national organisations. On the Welsh language, why does it take a Singapore-based consultant to tell us not to be afraid to share the language with international audiences? Right? It is quite astonishing. We don't need to be nervous about the use of the Welsh language. You know, Wales is unique amongst the four nations having a genuine bilingual community. That is an asset that we can trade on. It is one of the, I'm involved with Cardiff University in a bid that we're making to the Arts and Humanities Research Council on the development of creative clusters. And one of the things that we will concentrate on is, you know, how do we leverage this familiarity and the skills and expertise around bilingualism actually amongst so many other countries in the world where bilingualism or multilingualism is the normal everyday experience. It's the sort of, you know, English monolingual situation, I think, that is the aberration. Having said that, I've got to say very quickly, I recognise that there are now dozens of other languages being spoken in England in different communities. So, you know, that's a whole other issue. But one thing from my own experience, I have a son who's working in television and production, was involved in the production of Hinterland. Interesting that has now sold, it's recouped its money into internationally, right? And that has sold to about 70 countries, right? And there are both the languages of Wales are actually heard in it. You know, these are bilingual versions. You know, some of the Welsh is actually subtitled. You know, it's not actually a problem. Two other points before I finish, just to say the implications of Brexit. The university research is an absolutely key thing. And I don't think that we have addressed this afternoon the vulnerability of our research effort if there's any chance of us actually coming out of Horizon 2020 and whatever follows it. That is a major problem. We are not spending enough on R&D in the UK as a whole. You know, it's a real problem. We're way behind Germany and France in terms of R&D. So, you know, we can't afford to drop further back. When it comes to international students, when it comes to Erasmus, the number of students received by Welsh universities is not high enough. Britain's participation in Erasmus is lower than the participation of Germany, France, Spain, Finland, and a host of other countries. Let's not pretend that we're very good at this. We need to do more of that, and Wales needs to be in on that. We mentioned an audit of international activity. We need a systematic assessment of our European cultural networks and organizations so that we can develop priorities, right? You know, you can list dozens of European networks. We haven't got the people to be in on every single one of them, but we may need to identify, right, these are the top dozen networks that we need to be part of so that we can make our presence felt. And lastly, my last point, and you would expect this from the chairman of Wales for Europe, there's a real worry about the impact of Brexit. And there is a worry, I think, about the funding. Wales is disproportionately dependent on European funding in all kinds of ways. But I think it's not just the money. What really worries me is the atmosphere that is being created and the possibility, and I know UK governments will deny it 7 days of the week, but there is a real fear of a creeping re-centralization of the culture in this country. There's a real threat, I think. And it was very interesting. I read the Res Publica report that was actually done for the British Council. Right? There is not a single mention in the whole report of the existence of a Scottish government or a Welsh government or a Northern Irish government. It is not mentioned. The only cultural institutions that are mentioned in the whole of that report are the British Council and the BBC. You know, I mean, on what planet do these people live? And one of the dangers is, I think, in the current situation, is that in London and the South East, devolution is very often seen not as a reconstruction of the UK, but as an aberration from a unitary norm. And I think that there's a real concern, I think, that post-Brexit, that there'll be a kind of reassertion of that. That's enough for me. I think I've said enough.
Thank you, Geraint. Wow, what an impassioned list there. We didn't just have one or two hows, we had 7, 8, 9, 10. So thank you. That was a great start. So a strong message there that Welsh Government should lead. Strategy, infrastructure, scale, vision, innovation, important factors there from Geraint. Shona, would you mind addressing next how you feel small nations, regions and cities can use soft power capital to strengthen global engagement?
I'm going to resist the temptation to make any mention of why there's no Northern Ireland government mentioned in the report. And also thanks to Gareth, because he's already set out really the kind of Scottish infrastructure piece much more eloquently than I could. But I guess I wanted to start by talking about how uncomfortable I feel about the definition of soft and hard power in the first place, because soft automatically implies that something is less valued or less important. And I've seen up close and personal, from Belfast to Derry to now Edinburgh and many, many other places in between, that culture indeed and the impact it can have is the hardest form of power that we can have in any of our cultural relations. So I just wanted to set that out as my stall from the get-go. I also wanted to kind of talk about whether the good and the bad between sort of over, intervention from government into cultural practice, and whether that's a good thing or a bad thing. In my view, the best way to harness or to use the power of cultural relations is to locally value it, fund it, resource it, and ensure that creativity, creative learning, and the opportunity to have creative experiences is an entitlement for every young person who grows up in Wales, Northern Ireland, Scotland, or any other part of the UK. And I think that's the best way to harness your cultural power. My own background in Belfast, I headed up Belfast Field bid to be European Capital of Culture back in 2000 when Liverpool won. Damn you, Liverpool, I still haven't forgiven them. I headed up Derry, Londonderry, Legendary's year as City of Culture in 2013. And I'm kind of really, really struck by this notion of how we, when we choose to instrumentalise culture, Belfast didn't win, Liverpool did, Derry won because they were cities in need. There was no other answer for Liverpool at that time. When Glasgow won the Capital of Culture title, it was like there was nothing else on the table, so let's sort it out with culture as the driver. It was the same when the Edinburgh International Festival was first set up. It was set up in 1947 as a mechanism for reunifying Europe after the horrors of war. So we turned to culture in desperation, it seems to me. And I just think, here's my radical rant for the day. What if we just supported it all the time? What if we actually saw the value in cultural practice all the time and not only in moments of desperation? And this brings me back to the Edinburgh Festivals and why I am joyously living in this beautiful, structured, supported environment that you talked about in Scotland, because it genuinely, I just turned 50 this year, a kind of over 30-year-long career in the arts, and to finally be working in a place that gets it. That gets it at a policy level, that gets it at a political structural level, and that gets it at supporting the actual practitioners on the ground right through to the festival's infrastructure. I have to tell you, I'm smug, I'm enjoying every minute of it, and I genuinely see the benefits. The idea that you could describe Edinburgh's festivals, and one of the beauties and one of the things that drew me there is that we work collectively. None of us work in isolation, and I guess this would be my message to Wales is the sum of the parts is so much stronger than the individual trying to fight a battle alone. And working as a collective with the 12 Edinburgh festivals, the impact study that was done a couple of years ago showed that we are as big as the FIFA World Cup in terms of the numbers who come to and visit the city for the Edinburgh festivals. Only we do it every year, not every 4 years. If it was a sporting event, it would be shouted about from the rooftops, I have to say. And as well as that, you know, the economic impact is like 260 million into the city every year. These are not insignificant things. The director of Edinburgh's airport said this year that 10% of his new business annually is a direct result of the festivals. The Edinburgh universities will tell you that part of the reason for their success is that they sell themselves based on the city of culture that is offered as a backdrop to young students wanting to come there, and the guarantee that they may get to work on these kind of globally renowned festivals. this is not soft to me, this is hard, this is real. And that's before you even start to mention the social value, the impact on the human beings who live in the city. And contrary to the sort of stories that are told that, oh, the festivals kind of, you know, land in Edinburgh, happen and have no connection to local communities, this is deeply untrue. 800 Scottish companies participated in the Edinburgh Fringe last year. The percentages of local people who attend the festivals are the equivalent of the entire population of Edinburgh when you break it down. So local people do engage, they're part of it. And I just think, you know, I go back to my very first point that investment in all of this at the get-go. I was so excited to hear about the creative learning initiative that's happening here in Wales. You know, I think back to Ken Robinson's All Our Futures work that he did, well, in the early 1990s. It was revolutionary, it was brilliant. Northern Ireland embraced it. For once, I think we were ahead of the curve in Northern Ireland. It was a glorious moment there. And now you kind of, you know, we're in 2018 and you go, where did all of that go? 50 million hits his talk has on TED Talks, and you're like, well, what are these 50 million people doing? Because I'm not seeing the changes happening in our classrooms, in our schools. You know, so, you know, do something with this TED Talk. So I could, as you could tell, I could rant on many things, but I have to say it's a real privilege to work in Edinburgh. We had 62 countries represented across the fringe alone last year before you even talk about the other festivals. We don't work in isolation. We're politicised, we're political people. We bring the message and values of a place in everything that we do. Last year, on the 70th anniversary of Edinburgh's festivals, we went right back to what was the founding principles of the Edinburgh Fringe. And one of the beauties of it is it's an open access festival. It was like YouTube before computers were invented, and it happened in Edinburgh 70 years ago. And it still has that open access principle today. And so that was, we kind of went back to those founding principles, and we stopped talking about Edinburgh as the Fringe as the biggest arts festival in the world, and started talking about it as the biggest space for creative freedom of expression in the world. And that starts to communicate a different set of values in a kind of Brexit and Trump landscape. And that's the kind of conversations that we have with the international people who come and engage with the festivals. And it's powerful, and I see it day and daily. And yeah, I'll stop talking now. Shame.
Thank you, Shona. Yeah. Some excellent points there about consistency of support, collective approach, collaboration, connectivity, note to self, start relocation to Scotland plan. lots for us to take note from there, actually. It doesn't sound like that's a new approach. It sounds like it's been developed over a long period. Shane, over to you. You work all over the world. Please, can you give us your thoughts on how can small nations, regions and cities use their soft power capital to strengthen global engagement?
It was my story time. Thank you for having me, by the way. Sorry, it's such a fleeting visit. I was in Australia on Sunday or Monday, and I was with the director of the Mona Museum in Hobart, in Tasmania, who's also the guy who wrote the song Blister in the Sun. You know that song? Okay, good. You should if you don't. And we were talking about all this, and we were on the radio together talking about the role of music in city building. And for those who don't know me, I work around the world advising cities and governments on music policy and strategy. We're working here in Cardiff doing this. And he just, the thing he said is, the strategy is just to do stuff. That's it. Like, how did Mona succeed in Hobart? So Tasmania is a country within a country. For those who don't know, you know, it's the one province of Australia that has been, that has not received as much public funding as other provinces or states, I guess they would call it. And Mona is a private initiative. This museum is a private initiative. It's one guy's money. And he said all they did was just do stuff. And the more I'm traveling around the world trying to come up with these, you know, grand plans, I don't have any. Just be busy. And constantly do stuff. And do stuff in as many places as possible with as many people as possible. Ideally people who don't look like and sound like. I think that's the most important. And what we have realized is that we get caught up in the concept of diversity without actually doing the grunt work of diversity. I'm just looking around this room right now thinking that. And we, when it comes to small nations, I believe, and I'm from Canada, so originally, and I consider ourselves a small nation, let alone I know there's some Quebecers in here, and they're a nation within a nation, and Canada is massive, but there's like 30 million people. And I grew up in a small town that thought very differently to how I would say someone growing up in Quebec or someone growing up in British Columbia or something like that. And the one thing that I realized was if we go out of our way to communicate with people that are as different to us as possible, it is actually a lot easier to transcend boundaries, to get through boundaries, because small countries, in a way, have an ability to say less yet mean more. And the way I see it when it comes to Wales is Wales to me is incredibly rich in so many different ways. I love this place. I spend a lot of time in Wales, and I feel like there's not so much less to communicate, but a more deliberate, intentional, and structured pathway to communicate through culture and music. And I do believe that there's a significant amount, I think I agree with you, Frank, that there's significant opportunities, especially in music, to not only communicate with other cultures, other countries, but communicate in a deliberate way where your intentions are made clear, whether those intentions are cultural, economic, or social. And when I'm traveling around the world and Wales comes up, I do believe that people understand Wales as a concept without understanding the content that backs up that concept. And that concept is very, very positive. And if you start with, that's really, really important, because if you have a reputation that's good, then you're allowed to put whatever you want in it. In Canada, so for example, Canada, I think we're incredibly good at